Hi everyone, it's Stu here, your dulcet-toned podcast host. Are you tired of ads interrupting your favourite true crime podcast? British Murders, of course. I mean, who needs a 60-second detour when you're in the midst of an immensely well-told story? The irony of this being an ad isn't lost on me, but I wanted to let you know that you can listen to British Murders completely ad-free by signing up for a Patreon membership. For as little as £3 per month, you'll get early access to ad-free episodes, as well as a heap of other benefits. I've got a fair few bonus episodes you can sink your teeth into, and every Monday I drop a new episode of the British Murders Weekly Journal. If you enjoy exclusive giveaways, my Patreon has those too. Head to patreon.com/britishmurders and choose either my OBE or KBE/DBE tier to rid yourself of those pesky adverts. Plus, you'll be helping support your favourite podcast so that I can offer you even more content going forward. I'd say that I'll shut up now, but you've got the rest of the episode to listen to. Back to you, Stu.
This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Murders, the True Crime Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to a very special episode of British Murders. I have a guest with me. Welcome Grace from Red Rum. Thank you for coming on.
Hi Stu, thanks so much for having me.
You are my saving grace on this occasion because I've just finished season 12 and I wanted a week off. So I messaged Grace like 3 days ago. I said, please, can you come and tell me a story? And she said, of course. So here we are. Now, I don't think we're actually in Britain, are we, this time?
No, we're not. We are in America, classic.
We're in America. It is a murder story, but it's not British. But all bets are off because my season is finished. I need a little bit of a break. You're giving me that break, so I appreciate it. Before I get into the story, do you want to just give your little podcast and YouTube channel a plug so people can go check you out?
Yes, thank you. I definitely would love to do that. So I am the host of Red Rum True Crime. It started as a podcast, so you can find it on all your podcasts and apps. And about a year and a half ago, it moved over to YouTube, where it's changed names a couple of times, but now it's called Red Rum. And the focus of the podcast is always on the victim. So I really try and build up the story of the victim, which hopefully you will hear today and get a little bit of a taste of. And then I'll just go through in chronological order and tell you about the story.
It's basically the same as British Murders.
Yeah, I pretty much copied you, basically.
Copied my style, but with a far more soothing voice, in my opinion.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Been far too modest about YouTube. She's got like 30,000 followers on there. And she's complaining that it's stagnating. So give us some more subs, please.
Yeah. She was getting annoyed at me for saying that I stagnated at 30,000. But we were also saying it's kind of natural, isn't it? With the podcast or with YouTube, you get to a point where you're like, why isn't it going up anymore? And it just sort of stops. But 30,000 people is a lot of people. You're right.
It's true. So anyway, you're going to tell us a story here. I'm going to shut up and let you get on with it. So crack on, Grace.
Wicked. Thank you very much. So we'll start at the beginning. We'll start with this wonderful woman, Anna Maria Wilson. And she was known to all of her friends and family and eventually professionally as well as Mo. So throughout the story, I'm going to call her Mo. She was born in 1996 in New Hampshire. And she had a brother, Matthew, who she was really close to. And the pair grew up in Vermont. Now, growing up, Mo had always loved sports, and at some point in her sporting journey, she took a really keen interest in skiing. Her father, Eric, was on the Olympic ski team, and so she sort of followed in his footsteps. She went to Burke Mountain Academy, this ski school that churned out world-class athletes, and she was used to being around the best of the best and was rated incredibly highly on her college ski team. But Mo's skills weren't just in sport. She was also really smart, and she ended up going to Dartmouth College to gain a degree in engineering. So she had like a whole array of skills, and she was really, really good at all of them. Sadly, however, Mo was taken out of skiing action by a knee injury, which actually ended up making her retire early. And as part of this sort of recovery, Mo began using a bike through rehab, and it wasn't long before she fell in love with that sport of cycling. And Mo ended up getting a job as an engineer in a cycling repair shop called Specialized. And it wasn't long before she started taking that sport much more seriously, which was not a surprise to any of her family or friends. Once she was into something, she really gave it all of her. And both of Mo's parents were incredibly supportive of her. So she soon decided to quit her cycling repair shop job and pursue the sport professionally, give it her all, and just spend all of her time on that. So as part of this rejig of her career, her next move was to relocate to San Francisco, where she was well known in the cycling community, and her passion around inclusivity in cycling was something that was just as important to her as her success in winning races was. I think that's really important to say, because when I was doing the research, there were loads of articles on how amazing Mo was as a sports person, but I would say there were an equal number of things to read on how important inclusivity was to her and how she wanted to make cycling accessible for everyone. I think it's a real testament to who she was. So Mo continued to go from strength to strength. She'd either be winning or she'd be coming second in almost all of the top level races that she was entering. And over the following weeks and months, Mo would go on to compete across the country. And then in May of 2022, she was going to be heading to Austin. And while she was there, she decided to stay with a close friend who we're going to call Cash. The reason I'm calling this friend Cash is because she's got the same first name as someone else in this story. So she's not anonymized, but that's the reason. So she and Cash have been friends for years. And it just made sense that as she was going to be in Austin, she'd be staying with Cash in her apartment on Maple Avenue. On the 11th of May, Mo let Cash know that she was going to go out. She was going to meet a friend and she'd be back later on. And Cash was also heading out with different friends, and so they agreed they'd catch up later. That evening, Cash arrived home around 10 p.m., and she walked into her apartment to a brutal and bloody scene. Inside the bathroom, Cash found Mo lying on the floor, unresponsive and covered in blood. She immediately called 911 and performed CPR, but sadly, it was no use. Mo was dead. The investigating team determined that Mo had been shot a total of 3 times, and she had defensive wounds to her chin and to one of her fingers. They looked closer, and the later autopsy would reveal that she had been shot in her chest and then in her head, and there were 3 bullet casings discovered near to her body. Now, eventually, the investigating team looked into different theories, and they thought that this might have been a robbery gone wrong at first. The bike that Mo held so dear to her and was expensive had been dumped outside of the apartment in this nearby grassy area. But as the investigating team began to look more closely at the crime scene, they discovered that there was just no sign of forced entry and there was nothing that seemed to have been taken. So that robbery theory was looking less and less likely, but that left the question of what the possible motive could have been. Now, to discover what that might be, the team had to look into Mo's past. And to do that, we have to go back about a year. And that takes us to a man called Colin Strickland. Mo had met him in 2021. Colin was this professional cyclist, and he and Mo had hit it off back in that previous year. Colin had been relatively successful in what he was doing. He'd won some of the top level races. And as a result, he had huge sponsorship deals, including one with Red Bull. So when Colin and Mo met, she was 25, he was 35. And the pair began becoming romantically involved. But this really wasn't a long-term thing. This was a fling and it was very short-lived. It reportedly only lasted for around 2 weeks. He had been on this break or breakup, depending on who you talk to, with his long-term girlfriend, Caitlin Armstrong. And Colin had decided to give things another shot. And so that's when he broke it off with Mo after this 2-week fling. It seemed that Mo and Colin remained friends after that fling. And she told friends that she looked up to him as a pinnacle of excellence in his field. And the two did have this professional relationship. They both got on well. They were great supports to each other. And Colin had originally shifted from hobby cycling to professional. And so it's likely that because Mo had done a similar journey, she looked up to him in this regard. The following few months were a little unclear in exactly what was going on, mainly because of the sources that I looked at. They come from Colin's account. They also come from text messages and secondhand information. So it's a little bit conflicting, but I'll talk about the most likely version of events. And if there are conflicts, I'll talk about those too. I know, Stu, you and I had a conversation about when there's different kinds of information, trying to find the right source of information is sometimes quite difficult. So you've just got to go with what is most reported or what seems to be the most likely version of events.
Yeah, I would typically say, according to so-and-so, however, other sources claim something else. Can't say for sure what is true. Let's go with what might be the most likely. Rather than saying this is what happened when there's conflicting sources, that's a bit misleading. But yeah, if there's various accounts, just go with either what you think is most likely or according to a specific person in the story, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So that's sort of what I've tried to do here is either outline that there are conflicting accounts or go with the one that is most reputable based on the information. So Colin and Caitlin Armstrong's relationship was very serious. They lived together, they ran a business together, and that business was, they basically would spend their time renovating old caravans and trailers. And during this short breakup or break, neither of the couple said anything to their family and friends. And most people didn't even realize that they'd broken up because they were back together so soon after. It's not clear how Caitlin found out about Colin and Mo's fling, but she did. And so in the aftermath of that, she ended up blocking Mo's number on Colin's phone. And text messages would later reveal that Colin was worried about Caitlin's jealousy, stating that he couldn't tell her the truth about messaging friends that were women. And he certainly couldn't have Mo's name in his phone. If he wanted to stay friends with her, then he was going to have to lie to Caitlin. So he even decided to disguise Mo's number under a male friend's name in his phone. Big red flag, but that is what he decided to do. In January of 2022, there was a cycling event in Arkansas, and both Mo and Colin were going to be there. The pair did see each other there, and their texts would later reveal that there was a bit of confusion over what was going on between the pair of them. Mo had sent Colin a text message saying, quote, "Hey, so we'd like to talk to you at some point. Had originally texted you on Friday, but appears my texts aren't going through again. This weekend was strange for me, and I just want to know what's going on. If you want to be friends, seems that's the case, then that's cool. But I'd like to talk about it because honestly, my mind has been going in circles and don't know what to think." So as I said, there were conflicting accounts of what was going on. At one point, both Colin and Mo's families said that their relationship was purely platonic and professional. And Mo would often speak about how the pair would talk about sponsorships and biking conversations and both strategizing to progress their careers forward. So at least part of their relationship was platonic or was professional. That's very clear. So we fast forward to May 2022, and we know Mo was going to be in Austin for that competition prep. And so she texted Colin to ask to meet up. Colin had not only changed Mo's name in his phone, but he also regularly deleted messages from her, presumably so Caitlin would not come across them. Colin and Caitlin went their separate ways on that day, and they were both going on bike rides. But Colin told Caitlin that there was this woman in the cycling community, and unfortunately, she passed away, and he was going to ride his bike. He was going to go get some flowers for her to lay at her grave, presumably. But instead of going to get those flowers, Colin instead went to pick Mo up on his motorbike. And then just before 6 p.m., the pair went to a local outdoor pool for a swim before heading to get dinner at a local burger joint. After that, Colin brought Caitlin back to her friend Cash's apartment, traveling on his motorbike, before leaving sometime just after 8:30 p.m. After that, he dropped Mo off, and then he texted Caitlin a lie about where he'd been, and he added that he was happy to get food with her if she wanted and he'd be back soon. As part of the entire investigation, neighbours had given their Ring doorbell camera footage to the officers. And the officers reviewed this and they soon zoned in on a Jeep that seemed to be acting a little bit suspicious. They entered the license plate into their systems and a match came back for the car belonging to Colin Strickland. Now, obviously, in this situation, Colin being the last person to see her and a potential love interest, he's always going to be top of the suspect list. They also now had this footage of his car near the crime scene after the time he said he left. And so naturally, he was brought in for questioning. But Colin revealed that he had gone straight home after dropping Mo off, and he'd gone into the garage and he just worked there preparing his bike for the upcoming race. He said that Caitlin had arrived a little while after and she could very much vouch for him being there. But the investigating team checked that CCTV footage for the surrounding areas, including the route that Colin would have taken home, and they could see that his motorbike was indeed travelling back. And they later found that he was on the phone to a friend during the time that the murder was likely taking place. So there's just no way he could have been on his bike and in the car at the same time. And in his police interview, he revealed that although this Jeep was registered to him, he rarely ever drove it. In fact, at this point, it was basically Caitlin's car, which may be a little bit unsurprising. Detectives needed to speak to Caitlin, obviously, but they didn't necessarily have enough evidence to arrest her at this point. So instead, they managed to arrest her and bring her in on an unrelated warrant that had been out for previously failing to pay for some sort of beauty or Botox treatment. Caitlin was told that she was free to leave at any time, but they did want to ask her a few questions that were unrelated to the warrant they brought her in on. And she told them a little bit of information about her evening generally on the 11th of May. She confirmed what Colin had said about there being this woman in the cycling community who passed away. But other than that, she was pretty evasive. And they informed her that the car that she and Colin shared had been seen next to the crime scene, but she couldn't really explain why that was. And she added that she didn't know where Mo was staying. She didn't even know that she and Colin had been speaking or that they'd seen each other. Now, with this information and giving her a kind of prompt, the detective asked why Colin would say that she was the person driving the car, but she simply said she didn't know. And so then they asked if perhaps she was driving around that area just to blow off some steam and was upset at Mo having been with Colin that day. And that's when she said that maybe that could have happened, but she didn't really have anything else to add.
The story will continue after these quick messages. And now, back to the story.
At that point in the interview, she just says that she's had enough and she wants to leave. And the police have no choice but to let her go. They actually couldn't hold her in on that Botox warrant, even if they wanted to, because of this really bad luck technicality where the warrant was incorrect. It had an incorrect birth date that didn't match her actual birth date. And so she left. And when I say left, I mean disappeared. Once the police had managed to get a correct warrant for Caitlin's arrest, they couldn't actually find her. So as news spread about Caitlin being wanted in connection for this murder, Colin wrote up a statement that he posted on Facebook. Quote, "I am reeling from grieving Mo Wilson's death and from the facts that have emerged during the investigation. I cannot begin to imagine the pain felt by Mo's family and her close friends. Although it will be a matter of small consolation to anyone who cared for Mo, I want you to know that I have cooperated fully with investigators ever since I learned the terrible news, and I will continue to do so until some form of justice is served. After our brief relationships in October of 2021, we were not in a romantic relationship, only a platonic and professional one. It was not my intention to pursue along an auxiliary romantic relationship that would mislead anyone. Mariah and I were both leaders in this lonely niche sport of cycling, and I admired her greatly and consider her a great friend. I am deeply grieving her loss." Meanwhile, Caitlin, of course, was still on the run. And so her sister, Christy, was questioned by police about where she was at. She said that Caitlin had come to visit her in upstate New York for a few days, but eventually she dropped Caitlin off at Newark Airport so that she could fly back home. But Christy said that after just a few hours, Caitlin had called her back and said she'd changed her mind and was going to drive back to Austin instead. This didn't make any sense to officers. Why would she change her plans last minute and go from a 4.5 hour flight to an almost 30 hour drive? I know the US is like worlds away from the UK in terms of how long drives take, but 30 hour drive compared to a 4 hour flight just doesn't make any sense to anyone. So officers checked the airport flight details and they couldn't find any evidence of Caitlin leaving Newark Airport by plane. But the investigating team quickly realized that, of course, Caitlin was on the run and she may have flown out on a different passport. They also realized that she really didn't look too dissimilar to her sister, Christy. And so they searched the database to find outgoing flights from Newark Airport, but this time under Christy's name, and they got a hit. There was a flight showing Christy had traveled by plane to Costa Rica. But of course, officers knew that Christy was at home in upstate New York, so it became clear what had happened and exactly where Caitlin was at. However, the US Marshals were just unable to track her down. Even with support from the authorities in Costa Rica, it was proving difficult to locate her. The only information they had to begin with that she was staying in a hostel, but there were no specifics at this point. And so it did take them a while longer to get in contact with all the right people and eventually be pointed in Caitlin's direction. One big piece of information that they got was that Caitlin was now going by the name Beth, and she was working at a yoga studio in this popular tourist destination. So they headed straight there. But when they arrived, they had no luck, at least not in finding Caitlin. What they did gain, though, was information about where else she might have gone to. And so they ended up heading to this more remote village of Costa Rica called Santa Teresa. The detectives, when they got there, they attempted to blend in. They didn't want to freak her out. They didn't want her to run away before they got to see where she was at. So they were in this small town in Costa Rica. It's got a relatively small population. It's mainly holiday goers. And so these detectives who were undercover get dressed up to look as though they're also tourists. They go down to this big surfing competition that's going on and they try and seek Caitlin out. While this is happening, other detectives have managed to access her locker at the yoga studio that she was working at. Inside that locker, they found a passport, and that passport was a different name to what she'd been going by. And they also found receipts for plastic surgery under a fake name of Allison Page. That plastic surgery totaled $6,360. And they went to the surgeon, and that surgeon provided the police with records and photos of Caitlin's bandaged face. And in the photos, she'd also cut her hair shorter and she dyed it from blonde to brown. This all tallied up with the reports that they already had on Caitlin wearing this kind of bandage on her nose. And she had said to people that she met that it was from a surfing accident, but obviously it was from plastic surgery. So no wonder the detectives hadn't been able to find her. She had literally disguised herself with plastic surgery. The detectives still weren't having any luck in actually finding Caitlin. And so they decided to get her to come to them. They had spoken to a number of people about Caitlin during their time in Costa Rica. And one piece of information they got was that Caitlin had been going under different names and that she'd applied for a job as a yoga teacher at this other yoga lodge, but they had rejected her application. They knew that this was the person that they were looking for. And detectives also knew that she would be desperate for a job. And so they ended up putting a yoga teacher advert out. And it wasn't long before they got a bite. A woman going by the name Ari was interested. She was based at this hostel called Don John's, which was in Santa Teresa. And detectives knew this probably was Caitlin. So they arranged to meet her. They tracked her down to a hostel, walked inside. And the detective that walked inside saw someone that he thought looked very much like Caitlin standing in that hotel lobby. But he couldn't quite work out if the brunette in front of him was in fact who that he was looking for because of the surgery that she'd had. Now, remember that they don't want to make a scene just in case this isn't Caitlin. She could just be round the corner. He started talking to her in Spanish, knowing that if she genuinely was a local, she'd be able to have a conversation with him. But unsurprisingly, she wasn't able to. And she actually got her phone out and started to Google Translate what they were saying so that she could try and answer his questions. All this time, he's trying to be casual, just asking about the local area and the hotel itself. By all accounts, this woman standing in front of him was polite and super friendly. But as he got closer to her, he could see that even her overall appearance was different. It was Caitlin. And so there was no doubt about that. And they arrested her soon after. And she did try saying that her name wasn't Caitlin for a little while, but she soon gave that up. It turned out that the money that Caitlin had used to escape totaled over $450,000. And that money was money that Colin had given to her previously as a sort of investment. It wasn't her money to spend. And that the day after that she left police questioning on that Botox warrant, she sold her car, gathered as much money as she could, and fled to Costa Rica. That manhunt for Caitlin lasted almost 40 days. But once police found her and arrested her, they quickly got her back to Austin, and she was charged and would eventually stand trial for the murder. But before the trial could come, Caitlin actually managed to escape from custody. This story doesn't feel real. It does feel like a bit of a movie. She was being escorted by officers to a doctor's appointment in South Austin. And the officers had turned around to get some paperwork or something from the doctor. And the next thing they knew, Caitlin was just gone. Video footage shows her running away. And the chase lasted for around 10 to 15 minutes. At some point, she even removed her black and white prison issue trousers and was then just wearing her thermals underneath, which would have helped to disguise her inmate status. Thankfully, though, she was caught and she was brought back to prison pretty much straight away, where she was held until the trial. The trial itself lasted for 2 weeks, in which the evidence was presented that the forensics were able to tie the bullet casings found at the crime scene to the gun that had been found at Caitlin and Colin's home. And they managed to prove that these bullets and the casings were from the same kind of gun, but the defense disputed that this couldn't be proved with certainty. So that wasn't going to be a sort of smoking gun, as it were. The defense also stated that although a rape kit had been done on Mo, it wasn't tested. And they argued that this could hinder the case because it showed that the investigation hadn't looked at all avenues. Their main case was that they believed confirmation bias had been at play and that the investigating team just hadn't been doing all they could to look beyond Caitlin as a suspect. And on top of this, the defense revealed to the court that there was no evidence proving that Caitlin was the person driving the Jeep. But Caitlin didn't really have a leg to stand on. Her alibi was that she was in other places doing other things, but the defense failed to prove any of that. And it doesn't explain why the Jeep was seen circling the area surrounding Mo's home, especially given that it was provable that Colin was on his motorbike at the exact same time. The prosecution believed that Caitlin was on Colin's laptop on that fateful day, and they said she was likely on that laptop when Mo sent Colin a text, and that's how Caitlin knew when and where they were meeting. They also believed that Caitlin had used the Strava running app to track Colin's movements and lead her to find Colin and Mo at the apartment that night. Caitlin's DNA was even found on the handlebars and the seats of Mo's bike, that one that had been found in that grassy area just outside of the apartment. Finally, one of Caitlin's friends took the stand. She testified that one time when she was out for dinner with Caitlin, she'd been upset because she knew that Mo was in town and visiting Colin. That friend testified that Caitlin became, quote, visibly angry. And when she asked Caitlin what she'd do if Colin started dating someone else, she said, "I would kill her." The prosecution obviously presented all of their evidence, including the escape attempts, the plastic surgery, and the motive. And ultimately, Caitlin was found guilty. She was given a $10,000 fine and sentenced to 90 years in prison. The maximum sentence that she could have got was 99 years. And even though she wasn't given that full amount, the prosecution had only asked for a sentence of 40 years plus. So it's quite a statement to be given that long a sentence. Mo's mum, Karen's victim impact statement is so incredibly impactful. And although it did, of course, show anger towards Caitlin, it was way more focused on the kind of person that Mo was, and that she ended it by saying that if Caitlin had just spoken to Mo about this woman to woman, she would have listened. And I think that's probably the most perfect way to end this case, this episode, it just shows the kind of person Mo was and the kind of legacy that she leaves behind.
Wow. The murder of Mo Wilson. Thank you for that. That was a very interesting story. I hope everyone listening enjoyed that. I didn't expect the old twist with the not just moving away under her sister's name, but also the plastic surgery and stuff. That really is something out of a film, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. It's pretty crazy, isn't it? Because I think also when you make that decision to do that, she knows she's fucked up, obviously. She knows she's going to have to live away forever and ever, but she's literally changing her face. So she thinks she's going to get away with it. I bet it was the biggest surprise ever when the detectives turned up and she just knew. Well, I would say that she knew the gig was up, but she did try and convince them that her name wasn't Caitlin and that she wasn't the person she was looking for. So she probably didn't realise straight away. It probably took a little while.
Well, I suppose that does it then for this collaboration bonus episode. Thank you for that. Thank you for coming on. Give everyone a final plug before we end this episode, Grace. Remind everyone where they can find your excellent podcast and YouTube channel.
Thanks, Stu. So you can find us anywhere you get your podcast. Just type in Red Rum True Crime. My name's Grace, so it will come up and you'll see it's hosted by me. You'll hear my very, very soothing voice. Thank you, Stuart, for saying that at the beginning. And you can find it on YouTube as well if you search Red Rum True Crime. And I'll send you the link so you can pop them in the show notes if that's all right as well. So it's easy access.
Awesome. So that does it for another episode. Next week, I'll probably be back with an end of season special. It might be a two-parter, so bear with me. But until next time, as we always say, cheerio.